From Mississippi to North Dakota, Oklahoma to New Jersey, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, President Biden has proposed massive new spending on infrastructure, but are our roads and bridges really in bad shape? Robert Kroll from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here with the answer. Much of the GOP big donor base is meeting in Florida this week to discuss the future of the Republican Party. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Efforts by a Louisiana woman to provide respite services to caregivers hit a brick wall in that state's facilities need review. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Anastasia Bowden of the Pacific Legal Foundation. And Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, takes a look at the damage done to our economy by the COVID-19 pandemic on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Upgrading the nation's roads and bridges provided the impetus for President Joe Biden's infrastructure plan. Although only a small portion of the proposed spending would actually go to roads and bridges, the question arises, are they really in bad shape? For the answer, we turn to Robert Kroll. He is a senior affiliated scholar at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University and an emeritus professor of economics at California State University, Northridge. Bob, welcome to American Radio Journal. Bob, one of the suppositions that is made when it comes to the president's infrastructure proposal, and it is a belief that's fairly widely held among Republicans and Democrats and the general public, is that our roads and bridges in this country are in terrible, deteriorated condition. How true is that?
It's overstated. I think there's a number of organizations out there, for example, the Society, American Society of Civil Engineers, and they come out periodically with grades on our infrastructure, and they look at a lot more than just roads and bridges. I don't agree with their grading system. It's hard to figure out exactly how they come up with it, to be honest with you. And the thing your listeners should be aware of is they are a lobbying group. They spend between $1 and $2 million a year lobbying Washington. So you have to wonder a little bit about their objectivity. But no, I've looked very carefully at fairly detailed data that the U.S. Department of Transportation collects on roads and bridges. And the road data is very objective data. It's not just an opinion. It's actually a measure. They use a machine to actually measure the road surface. And what I find is that the roads are in better shape than I think the politicians portray them. They're not perfect, and they certainly always need maintenance and always need work, but they're in far better shape than I think portrayed by the president. For example, the president said 1 mile out of every five miles of roads in this country is in poor condition, and that's just simply not true. Other than maybe one category of roads, most of those different categories of roads, the percentage in poor condition are well below 10%. For example, rural interstates have gotten better over the last 4 or 5 years, and only 1.9% are considered in poor shape. Urban interstates, about 4.5%, which is quite a bit lower than what the president has portrayed and others have portrayed road conditions. So they're not as bad a shape as portrayed by politicians. There's some improvement in some categories, and so I think it's an overstatement.
In terms of bridges, everybody is concerned about bridge safety. Do you find the same situation where, yes, there are needs, but no, it's not quite as bad as what it's being portrayed?
Yeah, I think they will talk about like one-third are in poor shape. And again, working through the Department of Transportation data, I find only about 6% are in poor shape. 82% of states have actually seen an improvement in bridge quality over the last 5 years. And you have to be careful. It does sound scary when they say a bridge is in poor condition or rated in poor condition. You know, I can understand how you might say, ooh, man, maybe I don't want to go over that bridge. But that means a lot of things. It may simply mean that the bridge is too narrow, that there's been so much development and population growth around the bridge area that the bridge that they built 20 years ago is simply too narrow. So again, it's not really a safety thing. It can mean a lot of things, so you have to be very careful on how to interpret that. So bridges actually are improving.
In looking at the president's initial proposal here, Bob, the amount of money that is being targeted to be spent on roads and bridges, actually a very small percentage of the overall so-called infrastructure plan. Yes. Looking at the money the president is proposing to spend on roads and bridges, would you rate that as a necessary expenditure? Is this something that we really ought to be looking at doing?
It's $115 billion over 8 years. So if you're spreading that over 8 years, it's not a massive increase. But what I would like to see is, rather than recycling dollars from states to Washington, D.C., and then back to states, I would rather see the different levels of government divide up responsibilities. For example, it might make sense for the federal government to focus on the interstate highway system only, and maybe some of the older major U.S. highways, like Route 66 or something like that. That should be their sole road responsibility, the roads and the bridges on those highways, period. They could actually lower the gasoline tax to fund that, allow the states and cities then to manage those other roads. And they have the most information about conditions and what needs to be done. States could then make their own decision as to how high or how low they want the gasoline tax to be. I think that would be a much better system. I think you'd have better quality roads, and I think that would be a good reform.
In addition to roads and bridges, the president's infrastructure plan calls for a wide range of expenditures on other types of infrastructure. Could you fill our listeners in a bit on what sort of other infrastructure the president is looking at in this proposed bill?
They define infrastructure investment very, very broadly. And when you sort of look at what's in there, it's hard to figure out what they would consider not infrastructure investment. But for example, they're talking about expanding broadband in rural areas. Now, that may make sense because, from what I understand, from a private firm's perspective, it's not the most profitable market, and those areas may be underserved. And there could be benefits from education, telemedicine, that sort of thing. The problem with water supply in cities and towns. Now, generally, that has been a state and local responsibility, other than the federal government has set up some broad water quality standards. But for the most part, states and towns, communities, took care of it. But the lead pipes are a problem. And it might make some sense for the federal government to help fund the removal of those things. So evidently, there's potentially serious health consequences for some kids in some circumstances. But there is stuff in there that really doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense. For example, there's $52 billion going to manufacturing. Now, manufacturing is recovering. It can borrow in capital markets without much difficulty. It really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Expanding long-term care in Medicare, again, that's an entitlement. That's not infrastructure. More funding in-home care for elderly and disabled, perhaps a very worthwhile cause, but again, it's not infrastructure, and it's not clear to me why they put that in the bill. And those are just a couple examples.
We have been talking with Robert Kroll, who is a senior affiliated scholar with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He also is an emeritus professor of economics at the California State University, Northridge. And Bob, tell us a little bit about Mercatus Center. Also, where can folks go on the web to read your writing?
All you have to do is go to mercatus.org, mecatus.org. And you can find my writing, my work, and also the work of the other researchers at the center. It's a policy research group. We try to do very careful, hopefully objective research on important policy issues. And that's what the focus is of the Mercatus Center.
Robert Kroll of the Mercatus Center. Bob, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
At the Club for Growth, Scott Parkinson is keeping an eye on many different issues and angles to what's happening legislatively and politically around the country. Scott, good to have you here with us again.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
One of the big questions, Scott, on a lot of people's minds is, where does the Republican Party, where does the GOP go in the aftermath of the Trump presidency? What role will the former president play? Where will the party go? There's going to be a lot of chatter about that down in Florida with several gatherings this coming week. Want to fill us in on what's taking place?
This weekend, we're seeing a lot of Republican donors heading down to Florida and a destination for these events. But it's even more so a destination now with former President Trump camped out in Mar-a-Lago. This week, we're seeing our donors heading down with the Republican National Committee and also a couple of Trump-affiliated groups and other 501c3s that are trying to figure out exactly what the future of the Republican Party looks like and where Trump's America First vision and his agenda actually guides candidates in future elections. So I think it's going to be a pretty interesting time, and the chatter that emerges from these various events is going to be something that I'm certainly going to be listening to.
And is this chatter going to be more centered on who the party standard bearer is going to be in 2024, or are we looking more at the role of the party and all of the above moving into the 2022 elections, where obviously both the U.S. Senate and House are very much in play?
I think back to the 2012 election when there were so many concerned people over at the RNC that thought that they were smarter than everybody else, and they did an autopsy of the party. But the bottom line is, when you have a situation where a one-term president who was incredibly popular with Republican primary voters was defeated in an election that was incredibly close, Donald Trump is clearly still the leader of the Republican Party. And despite the posturing that we're seeing from some of the potential 2024 hopefuls heading down to Florida to be a part of the RNC event, they're going to be looking over their shoulder as you've also got some of these Women for America First events going on over at Trump's Doral Golf Course in Miami. Some of President Trump's most ardent supporters, including Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz and Rand Paul, are going to be featured over at that event. And you've also got folks that have consistently been lining up to get through Mar-a-Lago and catch President Trump's ear to talk about how they can be a part of his vision for the future of the Republican Party. I also think that a lot of these folks that are really concerned about the future of the party have largely been hesitant to buy into the Trump agenda from the first place. And they're always trying to weaken the conservative element of the Republican Party in order to attract more of these suburban women voters. And the bottom line is, I think if you want to actually build a strong base, you need to speak directly to the base and listen to the issues that they care about the most and not try to be Democrat light.
Another aspect of this, Scott, is the need for some election law reform in many states, because even though the media tried to portray this as there was no fraud, there certainly are a lot of Americans who believe that the election was not fair and that the rules that were changed contributed to that. So this does need to be addressed. And right now, the left has ginned up their outrage machine over changes in Georgia's election law. But tell us a little bit about what those changes actually are, Scott. And at the bottom line is, they're really very reasonable.
Yeah, that law in Georgia implemented pretty reasonable and common sense protocols, like requiring a voter ID for mail-in ballots and halting the acceptance of absentee ballots within 11 days of an election, and also prohibited third parties from providing gifts to voters waiting in line at a polling place. Now, the left is outraged because apparently a third-party political activist cannot deliver a bottle of Coca-Cola to somebody standing in line and trying to, you know, really persuade the way that they vote in the election. But Georgia's law has pretty much unfairly come under attack from not just the radical left, but also the mainstream media, who, without citing specific provisions of the Georgia law that made it harder for people to vote, instead they just called this Jim Crow. And we saw this week Major League Baseball cancel the All-Star Game, which was set to be played in Atlanta, and instead they moved over to Colorado, which actually has more stringent voter requirements when it comes to voter ID and how many drop boxes there are. You can also look at MLB's headquarters over in New York, and New York has very, very different voter access compared to Georgia. So it really wasn't a scrutinized process where they actually identified problems with the Georgia law But instead, we're seeing these woke corporations folding to the outrage that's been exhibited falsely, I think, by the radical left and the progressive left that really just want to try to scream foul on Republicans for strengthening election integrity in various states.
Well, the left is very good at ginning up fake outrage. And is some of this, Scott, laying the groundwork for the left wanting to basically federalize the election process as we see a bill pending in the United States Congress?
Yeah, we know that H.R. 1 and S. 1 in the Senate are the key priorities for Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. And, you know, I think it's kind of hard to say exactly what Joe Biden's priorities are, but the folks that help run the White House around him are certainly accommodating the far left when it comes to changing election laws for all states and trying to federalize what exactly helped Joe Biden beat Donald Trump in 2020.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, a few words for us about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. And if anybody listening is interested in checking us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org. And you can also check us out on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Louisiana's facilities need review requirements are preventing the opening of much-needed social service agencies. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explores one such case with Anastasia Bowden of the Pacific Legal Foundation.
Ursula Newell Davis wants to help special needs kids in Louisiana, but the state government there says there's no need for her services. And just wait until you hear the roundabout explanation that the state bureaucrats have come up with for shutting her down. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Anastasia Bowden. She is a senior attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, and she joins us now to talk about this new lawsuit that PLF has launched challenging this ridiculous regulation in Louisiana. Anastasia, thank you so much for taking some time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about Ursula Newell Davis, your client in New Orleans, and she got in some kind of weird trouble with the state.
Yeah, Ursula Newell Davis is an amazing human. She is an experienced social worker, a mother to a special needs child. And so she is very experienced with the special needs population in her community of New Orleans. And she noticed in her work that she was encountering families that lacked care for these children. You know, these families very often had to work, sometimes at odd hours, night shifts and whatnot, and that resulted in many special needs children being left home alone. And she had a lot of empathy for that because she has a special needs child herself and because she's a parent and she understands, you know, how taxing it can be to have a special needs child and that sometimes special needs families and parents need help. So again, she's an amazing human and she decided to set out and to fix this problem and to start a respite business that is a business that provides care for these families and these children to give parents a break or to allow them to go to work and still have their children supervised. And in the meanwhile, while she was watching these children, she was going to teach them basic life skills to make sure that they could thrive and live independent lives. But little did Ursula know that in Louisiana, you cannot simply start a respite business. You have to get what is in other states called a certificate of need, but what is in Louisiana called facility need review. And that is you have to prove to state bureaucrats that another business is needed. And Louisiana decided that there were enough respite businesses in the state, and they were going to deny her the ability to open a business despite her qualifications, you know, her master's degree in social work, her experience encountering children who needed help. That didn't matter to Louisiana. All that mattered to Louisiana was that they saw the number of businesses in the state and they decided that was enough and they denied her a certificate. And so now we're suing the state.
This is one of those things. This is one of those things that just really drives me nuts because, I mean, hearing you tell this story, right? It's clear that she has identified a need. But beyond that, I mean, it's sort of just ridiculous that the government is in the business of like weighing whether or not something is needed anyway. And then in a case like this, like clearly that need exists and she's filling it. But in practice, these laws generally don't really come down to a question of whether a business is needed or not, right? I mean, these things, and I imagine this is the case here too, are just ways for existing businesses to like fence out competition to keep new people out.
Yeah, as you say, it's sort of absurd absurd on its face. Why is the government better equipped to decide whether a new company is needed than the public? Usually we let the public decide, let the market decide. That's far more efficient, and individuals know what they need, not the government. But certificate of need laws are even worse than that, because the way that the government traditionally determines whether a new business is needed under these laws is by offering the existing businesses an opportunity to protest new applications, which subjects the applicant to a hearing, which is akin to full-blown litigation. Very often you have to have attorney, there's discovery. It's extremely expensive. And it allows the protesters to show up at that hearing and to testify that a new business is not needed. And in practice, the government takes the existing businesses' self-serving statements about whether a new business is needed at their word. And the result is what we call at Pacific Legal Foundation a competitor's veto, where the existence of a protest necessarily means that an applicant is going to be denied. So it's really worse than bad economics, where the government thinks it's better at determining need. It's just full-on cronyism.
Yeah, and why bother trying to outcompete your competitors when you can just have the government stop them from being competitors in the first place, I guess. We are talking with Anastasia Bowden, a senior attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, and as we hinted already, PLF is suing over this law in Louisiana and suing on behalf of Ursula to try and overturn these restrictions in Louisiana. Anastasia, I want to finish there, because there's been kind of an interesting back and forth already in this case. Tell us a little bit about what the state of Louisiana has said in response to your lawsuit.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing, because we suggested in our lawsuit that this law violates the Constitution because it's depriving people like Ursula of economic opportunity without any rational relationship to protecting the public. It does not keep costs down. In fact, research shows that certificate of need laws drive costs up, and studies bear out that certificate of need programs drive down access. So certificate of need programs do not drive down costs, they do not ensure adequate supply, and they don't result in better quality. Again, studies show that there is worse quality in states with certificate of need, or at best there's no difference between having a certificate of need and not. And so really, this law is simple protectionism and cronyism, as you said. It's depriving people of their constitutional rights with no good reason. And what the state has said back was, well, it's necessarily limiting the number of providers. That promotes administrative efficiency, administrative ease for us. The fewer providers there are, the more resources we have, the easier it is for us to regulate. And that alone is good enough to satisfy the Constitution. So the state is suggesting that it can limit the number of people working in the state solely because that's easier for the government bureaucrats. And that's just preposterous, in my opinion, and we'll see what the judge has to say about that.
Well, we wouldn't want the government bureaucrats to have to work too hard, right? I mean, I guess by that logic, you could like shut down every business in the state and then their jobs would be super easy. That's a completely ridiculous argument. I would hope that a judge sees it that way. We are unfortunately out of time for today. Anastasia Bowden from PLF, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And again, that is Anastasia Bowden, senior attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation. You can check out more of their fantastic work at pacificlegal.org, including more about this case in Louisiana. Check us out online at reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
And Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, has been a commentator on American Radio Journal since we launched this program back in 2008. He has been serving as a member of the Pennsylvania legislature now for a number of years, and those duties are taking up more and more of his time. So this week, we thank Frank for his many contributions to our program, and we offer his final American Radio Journal commentary.
The pandemic and the response to the pandemic have left the global economy in a precarious position. The consistency of the optimism of solid economic growth following the reopening are echoed in virtually every economic corner of the world. Just as then Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan made mention of irrational exuberance of asset values, followed by the major market declines in 1996, the mere mention of something other than massive economic recovery today are met with jeers and criticism from a cancel culture society. But just as Greenspan discussed in his books, The Age of Turbulence, the economic swings of the 1970s seem to swing more severely with each succeeding downturn. The current economic climate is ripe for a reset for which most of us are unwilling to consider and are equally unwilling to prepare for. Our national debt is $28 trillion and climbing rapidly to $31 trillion after the most recent stimulus bills being signed into law take effect. Interest rates for 7 to 30-year maturities are rising rapidly, whereas the velocity of money is plummeting to the lowest level in history. But why should you care? But one more measure of concern is the amount of negative interest rate debt worldwide in 2021. Such negative interest rate debt stands at almost $19 trillion worldwide. In my lifetime, I have been witness to some fairly catastrophic events. While in Eastern Europe, I witnessed the after effects of the fall of the Soviet Union. I served in Iraq and briefly in Afghanistan, in my own nation. I've seen the dot-com bubble bursting in 2001, the collapse of the housing market in 2008, and now the pandemic of 2020. There have, of course, been panics throughout the history of the world. The panic of 2020 and its aftermath in 2021, though, are different. We must understand those differences and deal with the entire spectrum of economic consequences and not just with those that make us feel complacent and comfortable. In the panic of 2020, the economy had been so strong in its underlying fundamentals that the triggering event, a pandemic, should be easy to overcome because of that underlying strength. The economic difficulty, though, is that we, and we alone, hold the key to whether the cure is worse than the disease. Rather than government spending and monetary policy helping our economy, it is entirely possible that the perceived rational theories of fiscal policy and monetary policy may have negative effects when irrationally applied. Temporarily stimulating measures of such policies may have a valuable effect when smoothing economic cycles, but when a society becomes dependent upon such stimulating policies, the cliff is merely getting higher from which we will eventually fall. Deflationary spirals and economic reset, read that to mean potential depression, are possibilities which must be examined in order to be avoided. Our economy has become dependent upon an irrational behavior of the federal government spending beyond the means and a Federal Reserve intent upon manipulating interest rates. Only by rationally reining in fiscal and monetary policies will our economy avoid the perfect storm. For instance, a declining velocity of money means people are hoarding cash and not spending it, and that's despite the horrible very short-term interest rates of almost zero. The implications of these potential causal effects of extremely low interest rates is that the Federal Reserve is in fact perpetuating the financial crisis and not solving it. The historic low velocity of money, which the Federal Reserve has reported for over 13 years now, reflects people hoarding money. The implications of this massive hoarding of cash are unknown. It's never happened before. Not to be outdone, the federal government to stimulate demand has been using deficit spending, but once again, to limited effect. Expansionary fiscal and monetary policy, therefore, have had little or no real effect on the economy because all of the participants in the market are offsetting these expansionary efforts as reflected in the declining velocity of money. The government's stimulating it, and we're slowing it down. Now is the time to challenge conventional wisdom of the efficacy of fiscal and monetary policy before the results of the poorly thought-out governmental policies of our federal government and our Federal Reserve leads us to our proverbial day of reckoning, for which we are in no way, shape, or form prepared. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KJAA-AM in Globe, Arizona, WMCE-FM in Erie, Pennsylvania, along with WLFJ-AM in Greenville, South Carolina. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program by visiting our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.